I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first introduction to the alphabet or numbers?
Well, I do, as a matter of fact. I did not go to kindergarten, but I started first grade before I was six. And I don't think I'd been taught the alphabet, because I remember it being on cards around the room, and I got it right away. I was so ready for school, having not gone to kindergarten, that I started reading pretty quickly and knowing the alphabet.
How come you didn't go to kindergarten?
My mother didn't want me to leave home. I was the last of her three children, and so she had made me stay at home. So here I was, raring to go by the time I got to first grade at five.
Do you remember, was there a book popular or part of the cultural zeitgeist that you can recall when you were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old? Like, what was your Sesame Street?
I don't remember the children's books that I was read, because... For one thing, the books that were being read were probably aimed slightly higher than my age, because my three of us were born in 3 years and 3 months, and I was the youngest. So I think probably most of the story books were aimed a little higher. I don't remember the books I was read until I started reading, when it was the Bobbsey Twins and the Little Colonel and those children's series. But I started reading chapter books right away. I did not spend much time on picture books, but I remember Dick and Jane, which was the first reading book in first grade. I remember it very well.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a banker. And so I grew up in a very traditional kind of home.
This was in the 1930s.
1930s and 40s.
In Arizona. Do you remember your first interaction with television, your early interactions with television?
There was the Adlai Stevenson-Dwight Eisenhower campaign of 1951, maybe, or 52. And I watched Adlai Stevenson's acceptance speech at the convention. That was the first thing I remember. And then it was two or three years later that the Army-McCarthy hearings came on and changed history, and I watched some of that. I didn't have a TV set, so I was dependent on the kindness of neighbors to see television.
You were in New York City in your 20s. What made you come to New York?
I had known, I don't know, from the time I was the littlest child, that I would not live in Phoenix. And I went to the University of Arizona for college. And all during that period, my best friends were people that wanted to leave Phoenix and do something. And one of them, I went to Washington. So I joined her and her family in Washington after I graduated and worked for the federal government in the State Department. And then I went back to Phoenix and worked on a newspaper until I saved enough money to move to New York. But that was almost always the goal.
What did you do when you came to New York?
I tried to get a job at the New York Times and was eventually offered one on the women's page, naturally, and that was easy for me to turn down. What I had in mind was being an intrepid reporter on stories. And I had been on the women's page of the Arizona Republic, but they had given me lots of broader assignments than writing about weddings and tea parties and that sort of thing. And I knew the women's page at the Times would be restricted to weddings, and that was not for me. And I went into the press and public information department of RCA, which owned NBC. And as soon as I could, I transferred down to NBC and did publicized their soap operas and other kinds of programs that they had, other programs that they had.
And what was your personal life like at the time?
I lived with a girl I had grown up with in Phoenix, and she was an actress and in Hollywood most of the time. So I had her apartment, and she knew everybody in New York for a variety of reasons. Her family was in Phoenix very prominent, so they met every Easterner that came out, every famous Easterner. So she knew, she had a very wide circle of prominent friends, and she very generously shared all these people with me. So I was in a life that wasn't, that was very starry, and that part was fun, but I was, felt not up. I mean, here I was with no achievement at all, and I was with people who were directors of television plays and director of Broadway plays and heads of production companies and all of that. And here was little me, was how I felt. But eventually I left RCA and went to NBC and then left NBC because I couldn't make enough money to live, mm-hmm. practically, and went to work for the U.S. Steel Corporation to publicize their play that was on every 2 weeks on television called The U.S. Steel Hour.
What was that about, The U.S. Steel Hour?
It was a drama every 2 weeks. It alternated with someone else's, another corporation's drama. But ours was produced by the Theater Guild, which was a very prominent production, Broadway production company in New York. And so I learned a lot about theater, about casting. It was in the bad old days when we had there was a list of people you couldn't cast in, or whose names, whose plays you could not accept, because they were said to have red ties.
Communist ties.
Yeah. So it was an interesting period that you had to clear, that we had to clear all names with the advertising agency.
How did you develop an interest in entertainment and in journalism? Your dad was a banker. Your mom was a housewife from Arizona. How did you fall into that world?
Well, I took acting and acted in the plays, school plays, and little theater when I was in high school. So I always had an interest in being an actress. But my father said, if you are an actress, you will never receive a penny of support from me. Thank God he said that, because I had the interest, but I was much better behind the scenes, behind the camera, as it were. And I majored in education and came out certified to teach in Arizona, which I had no intention of doing. But in those days, mothers said to their daughters, in case your husband dies, you'll have a job that will give you the same hours as your children and the vacation time when your children have vacation time. So all the little girls of my generation, or many, majored in education. But I never was going to spend my life with children and women. I mean, at that time, I wanted to be where the action was, and that's where journalism and television and so on.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street in 1969. The germ of Children's Television Workshop started at a dinner party that you had at your home with your husband, then Tim Cooney.
That's correct.
At the time. How did that happen?
Tim and I were friends of Lloyd Morissette and Mary Morissette. Lloyd was vice president of Carnegie Corporation, the big foundation. And we were very close to my boss at Channel 13, who was a very theatrical, dramatic, and brilliant man. So he was there at the dinner party, plus someone I worked with named Anne Bement. So it was six of us. And Lewis, this very dramatic boss of mine, started talking in a very stunning, interesting, compelling way about the educational potential of television. His talk sparked something in Lloyd. Carnegie Corporation was financing studies of how children learn, child development, and so something clicked in his mind of why not use television to teach preschoolers? Because preschoolers were marching to the center of the stage at that time. The government was talking about creating something that became Head Start. Early childhood had become more interesting to educators than it had ever been before. And so he asked me if I'd be willing to take a leave of 3 months from being a producer at 13. I was producing adult shows, talk shows and documentaries, but I was frustrated because you can do one documentary after another and have no effect on the society. And I wanted to see if television could make a real difference. That had been haunting me. So it was a perfect moment for me when Lloyd said, "Would you like to do this?" And the answer is, yes, I would, even though my boss didn't want me to. He wanted me to stay at 13. I took a leave from programming for 3 months and went all over the country talking to educators of preschool children.
You wrote a paper as a result called "The Potential Uses of Television in Preschool Education." And what were the major findings of the paper?
I met with several gifted teachers of gifted children, teachers of preschool children who were in pilot programs that the government was doing as a precursor to Head Start. And if they had said no, this would be terrible. We couldn't have done it. But they were very supportive of the idea. It was all yes, why not? It was so I did a report on their reactions, and then I did described something like Sesame Street, an hour a day, a show that would be something like Sesame Street run by a corporation, a nonprofit corporation, something like the Children's Television Workshop, which is now called Sesame Workshop. And so you could see it on paper, and it was very well received, the paper, by Carnegie and Ford and the government.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact. We'll hear more from Joan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So as a result of this paper, you suggested the launch of the Children's Television Workshop, and you suggested that they start a show which was at the time not called Sesame Street. How did you come up with the name Sesame Street?
Well, we were panic-stricken toward the end. We did not have a name. We had decided to put it on a street. We knew it was going to be on an inner-city street. We even knew what street. It was a copy of a street in East Harlem. And
which street was it? Do you know?
I can't remember, but it is something like East 116th Street. I've seen it. It was a street that, by the way, had a mural on one of the buildings, and we had that mural on Sesame Street. So once we knew we were on a street, we had to then find a title. There was even someone wanted to call it 123 Avenue B, and I said, that's too hip and too urban. So finally we got a list of about 60 titles, and we all decided that Sesame Street was the least bad. I don't know why we hated it, because we were hip. It was the late 60s, and so that's why Sesame Street seemed oh so sweet, and we did. Nobody wanted sweet, and then we all wanted sweet. I decided sweet was better. And so that was how we got Sesame Street. Partially, the head of our public information was saying, you guys are going to go on the air without any audience.
How did you come up with the idea of having the show be in a city with an urban feel?
Well, we had three extraordinarily gifted producers, John Stone, Sam Gibbon, and Dave Connell, all of whom had worked on Captain Kangaroo previously. John Stone was something of a genius, and everybody knew it at the time. And he's the one that came up with the urban street idea. And we all said, yeah, because our mandate was to reach inner city disadvantaged kids primarily. If we didn't reach them and reached everybody else, it would have been considered a failure.
At what point after it started airing did you say, wow, we have something much bigger here in our hands than we ever expected?
Right away, actually, as soon as it went on the air, the reaction was like swoosh. The press was overwhelmingly favorable, and the audience reaction was overwhelmingly favorable. There were some academic critics, but there were very few of those, and I remember every interview I did with the press, they'd say, how do you feel about your critics? I wanted to say, that is so the least of what we're dealing with here. To me, it was so actually trivial compared to what was really happening out there that it was like, for me, batting away flies. That's not nice to say, but that's how it felt. It was an amazing moment because the women's movement was coming on stream. So the press was not only deeply impressed with Sesame Street, but deeply impressed with the fact that a woman had founded it, which meant they all wanted to talk to me, I kept bringing along Dave Connell to interviews and felt terrible that these geniuses weren't getting the attention they should.
You launched Sesame Street in November 1969.
That's right.
And that was with the help of producers like John Stone, who had been at Captain Kangaroo
yes.
prior. How did you meet Jim Henson, and how did that collaboration begin?
Well, I had seen a reel of his work, and he was so admired within the industry, much less known outside, that it never crossed my mind that we could get him. And John Stone and Dave, and probably Sam too, had worked with him. They said to me, I think we'll talk to Jim Henson, the producer said. And I said, Jim Henson? I mean, to me that was like saying Peter the Apostle. It was amazing. And I said, do you think he would do it? And they said, who knows? But they went and talked to him, and he said he didn't want to do little children shows, that he would then be categorized as a little children's producer, and that terrified him because he considered himself a family program producer, like The Muppet Show was his ideal show. However, he went home and thought, I have four children. He eventually had five, and it would be something to do for them and their peers. So I knew when we captured Jim Henson, I knew we had it, that we couldn't fail. And then Joe Raposo, the great composer, musician, came to work for us.
A lot of people came to you because they were driven by civil rights.
Yes, they were interested in children, but they were the idea of expressing the interest in what was going on in America, the civil rights movement, expressing it by trying to reach these children in need was very appealing to this group. Mm. I don't mean that they weren't interested in children because they were interested in civil rights, but the two interests they had came together perfectly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. You mentioned right from the start that the show was widely accepted. What was harder for you than you thought it would be in getting Sesame Street off the ground?
What was harder? It was so much luck. We had so much luck. The timing could not have been better for raising the money, because at that time government and private foundations were, and then Corporation for Public Broadcasting came on stream, and public television as a big entity, they were interested. So the timing was all amazing. In the beginning, we had a hard time convincing some of the representatives of the federal government that Children's Television Workshop, an entity that did not exist and had never produced children's programming, headed by a woman who had never produced a children's program. It was hard convincing them that that was the way to go rather than give the money to a cartoon company. And so we had to kind of battle our way through that. But eventually everybody got aboard, even though a woman at one of the foundations, Ford, said it will never be taken seriously if a woman heads it.
How did you get funding for the show initially? You just talked about this perfect storm of the federal government and private foundations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting coming together.
We couldn't possibly have raised it had it not been for the brilliance of Lloyd Morissette.
Who at the time was the head of the Carnegie Foundation.
He was vice president of Carnegie, but the driver of this particular project. He knew Harold Howe at the Department of, then the Office of Education, but it would be the department now. And that, we wanted half the money from the government and got it.
How much money did you raise initially?
We raised $8 million originally. We raised four from the private foundations and CPB and four from the government.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yes.
Now, $8 million in 1969, that's not an insignificant amount of money.
No, it would be like a 40 or 50 today, and people were shocked that that kind of money was being raised for a children's show. When we announced it, it was front page New York Times because it was unbelievable that anyone would spend that kind of money on children. And then the social purposes of the program caught the fancy of the Times and other press.
You mentioned the terrific response that the show got by critics, but there were still some people who were skeptical because you were using television as a medium. What were they saying?
I had made the mistake of saying that maybe we could close the gap between the achievement of poor children, disadvantaged children, and middle class, and that was picked up that within a few months that we certainly weren't closing the gap. And that was absolutely accurate because the middle class was making gains too. So it moved everybody up, but it didn't close any gap. So that was a very unfortunate phrase. So that was criticized.
Now, what was going on in your home life at the time? You didn't have children, so you didn't have to focus on that. But certainly your life had experienced this sea change, going from a producer of public television, and all of a sudden this storm comes of Children's Television Workshop and Sesame Street that was much larger than you ever expected. Can you talk me through those days of working on this early on?
Well, I was working all the time. And I think it was hard on my husband. I don't question that. That marriage ended in divorce in 1975, and it had nothing to do with Sesame Street, but I'm sure it was hard on him, all the focus on me. And I remember hating that we'd walk into a room and everyone would ignore him. So I'm sorry about it, but there was nothing I could do about it. And he was interesting. He was very involved in civil rights and was very helpful to me in many ways. He was the first feminist I ever knew. I had never met a woman who was a feminist, even.
Especially the woman at the Ford Foundation.
Yeah, right. But he was a feminist, so he was always pressing me to aim at being number one. He was also a very good writer and could help me when I was doing speeches and various things. But eventually he had problems that were not really manageable.
But he was always supportive of what you were doing.
Oh, very.
You are married now to Pete Peterson.
Yes.
And he is the founder of the Blackstone Group.
Yes.
Incidentally, did Pete Peterson play a role in Sesame Street at all?
He did, oddly enough. He was on the board of NET, and NET was the old National Production Center for Public Broadcasting. And I wanted them to administer the workshop for the first year and a half because we didn't know if we wanted to hire lawyers and accountants and all that. What if we failed and had all this staff to fire? So my idea was hire those that we had to have and then ask NET to supply the lawyers, accountants, and administration. And in order to do that, Jack White, who was president, said, you've got to present that to my board, and they've got to approve. And Pete Peterson was on the board, and he asked question after question. He was just fascinated with the idea and came up and said, this is one of the most interesting ideas I've ever heard. Well, naturally, I never forgot him. But we were both married to different people. Our lives went on in separate ways. And then we finally met again when both of us were divorced. It was very romantic.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street. What did Sesame Street look like in 1969?
It was slower. It was accused of being too fast-paced. But when I look at the early shows, they seem very slow to me. We've changed it a lot now. Elmo was not on early shows and became the superstar when we were about the superstar when we were about 20 years into it. And he now greatly is far more popular than Big Bird. But Big Bird is iconic. I always say he is held up like a crucifix to vampires in the Congress every time they threaten to cut us.
So Sesame Street took off immediately in the United States.
Yes.
When did it start to go global?
Well, the Germans came to me within a year and asked if they could do a co-production for Germany. And their Big Bird was a bear. And Bert and Ernie are a huge sensation in Germany and have always been. And then the next thing that happened was that Latin America wanted a version, and we ended up doing that in Mexico for all of Latin America except Brazil. And then it began spreading to the Netherlands, Canada, which took the American show but inserts Canadian films, and they've made it. It's called Sesame Street North. Australia, the English-speaking countries like Australia and Canada wanted it pretty quickly.
Except for England.
Except for England. Just wanted the Muppet pieces, did not want Sesame Street because they did not want Americans teaching English children. Now, of course, we're in Bangladesh. We're in South Africa with an AIDS-positive Muppet. And we're working in Pakistan, and we're starting an Afghanistan version.
And how is that perceived by society in Afghanistan, which tends to be conservative? How do you make adjustments accordingly?
We work with their people and their educators, and they choose what they want to emphasize. They may not want to emphasize letters and numbers. They may want to emphasize the values of mutual respect and understanding, which is a big value in our foreign productions. There's one version in Northern Ireland which emphasizes mutual respect and understanding. We're in Israel and Palestine with different versions. We had hoped to have more unity, but it didn't work out.
And there are characters that remain the same throughout all the countries, like is Oscar the Grouch in all of these?
So Oscar is, and Big Bird are the same puppeteer. No, they, for example, Israel's Big Bird, or the iconic Muppet, is a porcupine. Tough on the outside, soft on the inside. One Israeli said it should be the reverse.
Your whole life has been focused on children's education through entertainment, yet you don't have any children of your own. How come?
Well, I wanted children, and that just didn't happen. I really was deeply disappointed in my first marriage that didn't happen, but it didn't. I ended up with five stepchildren and nine grandchildren. So children are very much in my life now and have been for many years. Many of the greatest artists, of writers, playwrights, book writers of children's television, of children's material, have never married and don't have children. Maurice Sendak is one that's never married and has no children.
He's Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. So is the author of Alice in Wonderland, I believe. I don't know. It's a very... Many men, many single men are big artists and writers of children's material. I can't be sure, but I would suggest it's because they still have the child in them for whatever reasons.
Do you feel like you have an inner child or a child within you?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. But the grown-up has conquered. And those are those that keep the child stay creative, and those that have, the grown-up conquers become the executives. Darn. I have this theory that we're all sort of a combination of our fathers and mothers, and that my father triumphed finally in me, because much of me was very satisfied with being an executive, of bringing order out of chaos and being the boss. I really loved being the boss. I made up an aphorism that was in Forbes magazine, which is, I've been bossed and I've been boss, and believe me, being boss is better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and one of the founders of Sesame Street.
Coming up, we'll meet Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital invitations. Users can choose all the design elements of a card, ranging from font to color, pattern, size, and Paperless Post has delivered more than 60 million invitations and cards since its inception in 2009. Alexa started the company when she was 23 years old with her younger brother, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you describe what Paperless Post is?
Paperless Post is, it's a website that you go to and you can design anything that you'd buy in a brick and mortar stationery store, except that you send it all online. Once you've designed it, you put in your recipients' names and email addresses. When you send it to them, they receive it in their inbox and you can track their RSVPs. And I think the key difference between us and other online invitation companies is that it really looks like what you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, from the texture of the paper stock that the invitation appears to be printed on to the envelope with the receiver's name on it that shows up in their inbox and the animation for the more formal cards.
You co-founded the company with your brother, James. How did the idea for the company originate?
It was the result of a series of conversations that James and I had about various things that we wanted to do together. In the beginning, it was that we wanted to work together on a movie, on a film, so he would be the director and I would be the writer and producer. And then I had an idea for another company where it also involved the internet and a mass customization tool where people would design their own suits, and they would get made in Vietnam and in Hoi An and then get sent to the U.S., Neither one of those panned out, but we kept talking, and James called me one day and had this idea. He said, you know, I think that if this were available, people would use it, and I think that they'd probably pay for it, too. I remember responding and saying, I think that you're right that people would use it. I don't know whether they'd pay for it, but I think that we should do it.
Your brother was at Harvard, where you also had graduated from. Do you know how he came up with this idea at the time?
He was actually planning a birthday party for himself. It was his 21st birthday. He'd ordered palm trees, little mini palm trees for $5 each, and printed cups that said Beach Club. You know, it was in the middle of winter, but they said it said Beach Club on them. But then when it came around to actually inviting people to the party, he really didn't have very many options because it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks away, and he didn't have people's home addresses, and he didn't really have enough money to spend on printing invitations. But at the same time, he didn't want to use Evite or email, which wouldn't express how cool he knew the party would be. So it was actually out of his own experience that he came up with the idea of paperless post.
What were you doing at the time that also was leading you in the direction of wanting to start an online business?
There are a lot of other thoughts that went into doing this kind of company. One of them is that I was working at an older media company, and I was noticing the difficulties that they were having monetizing their content online. It seemed like a really, really big, scary thing for a lot of people and an opportunity for young people who were looking for an opportunity to be creative and solve a problem that the world needed.
You mentioned you had been working for a traditional older media company. That's CBS. You were Katie Couric's assistant.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
I had worked with her at the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And the reason I got that job was because I speak Greek and read and write Greek because my mom's family is Greek American. So it was all very roundabout how I ended up there.
When you were at CBS, you did receive a lot of invitations in the mail. Did that influence your thinking that, you know what, maybe this could work?
We did receive a lot of invitations at CBS for Katie. But one of the interesting things was that if people were trying to follow up, they would always do it by email. So it meant that essentially for any invitation, there also had to be a digital version. So all of a sudden, it seemed as though the print version was sort of a formality.
Your brother was very specific about his idea, and he is somewhat of an artist. What is his background in the artistic area?
He's entirely self-taught in terms of visual design and graphic design. His entire life, he's been practicing art. So he was a photographer, he was a painter, coin collector, stamp collector, sculptor. And I remember seeing other people's reaction to the things that he would make. And it would be things that he would make in his room. But I remember seeing my mother's friends at our house and always having the same kind of reaction, being impressed. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I also thought about when he was telling me about this idea.
Your mom is from Greece.
From Greece via Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how about your father?
My father's from New York City.
What did your parents do? What do your parents do?
My parents are both lawyers. Mm. And my dad now practices real estate. And my mom is actually a in-house counsel at Paperless Post.
You mentioned that your mom is Greek and that you speak Greek. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, languages were the thing that I was that made me most interested in school initially. So I speak and read and write modern Greek, and I speak Spanish, and I also know Latin and ancient Greek as well from school.
How do you think that's informed any of this?
I think it's informed a lot of it because I am really interested in the programming languages that we use, and I've learned enough about each of them to understand what I need to know about how they're used, and that makes my job really fun.
When you say programming languages, you're talking about computer programming languages, the plumbing that goes on behind what you see.
That's right. It's what makes it all work.
Because ultimately, it seems like, as well as being a design-oriented company, Paperless Post is a technology company.
Yeah, and more of that, half the people that work at Paperless Post are software developers.
You were 23 years old when you launched the company, and your brother was 21. How did that help or hurt?
So somebody told us once that one of the things you learn when you start a company is that everything that you think is going to be easy is really hard and takes a really long time, and everything that you think is going to be hard is really hard and takes a really long time. And one of the benefits to being a really young person with very little experience when you start a company is that you really do not have much fear about what's going to go into it, and you have the energy to stay up all night, and you have the fearlessness to write somebody that's more senior than you and ask them to work at your company.
Who was one of the people you wrote letters to, senior executives?
I think it wasn't as much senior executives. Mm-hmm. It was more people that knew things that we didn't know, like very, very good software developers. There's a very important technical culture at our company, and that was really founded and cultivated by Aaron Quint, who is our CTO. And in the beginning, he contracted with Paperless Post, and he really wasn't going to come on and work full-time because he had a really great career contracting. And so hiring people that were really different from us and not being scared to ask them to come work with us, and the fact that we were all young, he's also my age, was definitely a benefit in terms of building the company.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that enables users to email custom-made stationery that wouldn't typically be sent over the internet. Users range from individuals to institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the National Gallery. So you had this moment where you thought, okay, we're gonna give this a try. Your brother was still in college, and you were still working as Katie Couric's assistant. What happened then?
What happened was that it was a process of working backwards from the end product that James had defined, the unit of which was a card that was customized. We worked backwards to understand how you would have that be sent over the internet. We quickly realized that it would be via a design process that a user would be in control of, which meant that we needed to create a tool online that would enable a user to create that end product. On nights and weekends, we would meet with a lot of different people, and we would also spend a lot of alone time in our parents' house, or when he was at school and I was living at my parents' house, laying out and designing what we could do. And for him, that was the card and the cards and the format of the end product. And for me, it was the user interface that would enable users to design those cards.
How did you raise capital in the early days? And how much capital did you need early on if it was just you and your brother?
We didn't raise capital until we launched in 2009. We were able to raise capital because we had traction, because we had users, not because we were telling a story about a future when we would have a product and have users.
Once you launched the site, what were the first invitations you sent out, and how did you get traction initially?
Well, we never sent out invitations. So what happened was that there were people that knew what we were doing and asked us when they could use it. And so I had said to a friend that she could use it by September 30th, and she kept bugging me about using it. She kept bugging me, and finally I gave her a password, and I didn't think she'd be able to use the product or navigate through it. And then she gave me a call a few hours later, and she said, "So did you see what I made?" And I said, "No, I didn't see what you made." And she said, Well, can you just go on the site and log on and look at this invitation? Do you like the font color I chose? Do you like the font I chose? Do you like this? I thought it was really great that I chose that champagne bottle. And so she ended up sending that invitation to, 200 or 220 people. And honestly, there is no other way to describe how people started using Paperless Post other than that party.
What was the party for?
For her 22nd birthday.
One of your board members is Ram Sriram, who was an early investor in Google. How did you meet him?
We actually didn't meet Ram personally. He received an invitation or multiple invitations, and so he ended up going to the homepage of Paperless Post and reading about the About Us, and then maybe doing a little more Googling about us, and then wrote us a really warm email to our help email. We wrote him back, and we ended up having breakfast with him in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital stationery. Paperless Post makes money by selling virtual coins for customizing its cards, and the company became profitable in 2010. Your chief operating officer, Lucy Grayson, helped you define the strategy and the business model for the company. How exactly was she helpful, and how do you make money?
I'd say she's been extremely helpful because she came in and helped us define who we were as a business, not just as a product. By her asking, we had to think really hard about how were we going to make money, and a lot of the options didn't fit with the product we'd created because having ads would have meant interjecting between two people's communication. My brother made the comment in a New York Times article that you would never have a flyer in a wedding invitation, so why would you have an ad on an online wedding invitation? And by April of 2009, we deployed a direct-to-consumer payment model. So I credit Lucy's involvement greatly with our self-definition as a business.
What were some stumbling blocks for you in the early days? You were fortunate in that you had a clear concept for the company and that you got traction pretty immediately. What was harder for you than you thought?
Every business that you create, there's also a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. We did learn along the way that there were a lot of other things a business required to succeed, such as email deliverability, which is one of the most detail-oriented and difficult sets of rules to learn. But James somehow became our in-house email deliverability expert
guru.
I remember Lucy saying early on when James was on a call about email deliverability, she was like, thank you for caring so much. And it was true. It's just out of pure care to learn something like email deliverability. And a lot of things that are not pretty go into creating an actual company.
Paperless Post offers a platform for design partners, ranging from large companies like Crane and Boltman Geller to boutique stationers. But it wasn't always that way. You didn't always have these outsourcing design partners. What were some of the first designs that you and your brother came up with?
One of the first ones was called Saint-Germain, and it was a cream rectangular invitation that had a gold bevel and rounded corners, and it just had a simple script font, and it was extremely formal and actually probably not financially viable to send with paper, but that and a few other invitations. One had a silk black ribbon, and it was sort of a shimmery silver paper stock. That was also very popular. Basically, we started out with this line that was extremely formal, and the interesting thing was that when users saw Paperless Post in the beginning, they just felt that that meant that they could use us for formal things, so they started using us for things like, you know, engagement parties or rehearsal dinners and later on actual weddings. And that wasn't really a core part of our plan, but it was amazing that that happened as a result of the type of cards that we originally started with.
You mentioned, you know, silk shimmery paper stock and liners. Now, we have to remember this is all virtual. What are some other designs you came up with?
One of the famous cards that we started out with was red, and it had black and white zebras jumping across the border, and it was based off of a wallpaper at an Italian restaurant in Midtown called Gino's, which I think is sadly now closed.
On Lexington Avenue in New York City. Paperless Post is effectively making stationery more affordable using a digital medium. For instance, you have a calligrapher named Bernard Meisner, who in the real world, his artwork and his actual cards are very expensive.
Bernard Meisner is one of the best calligraphers in the world. One of the wonderful things about having these design partners was that we could have people like Bernard Meisner, whose cards are normally at the mid-range, $6 per item, allow that type of design to be accessed by people who would not otherwise be able to afford to use it. And basically the reason for that is that we are only offering the design itself and the visual quality and not the cost of producing it in physical form.
You mentioned $6 per item. Do you mean per letter?
Yes.
Who is another artist, designer, that's offered on the site whom you particularly like?
Mr. Boddington is a line that is on Paperless Post. It's a sub-brand of Mr. Boddington, which is an offline artisanal stationer in New York City. The sub-brand is Mr. Boddington's Nephew, and it's been incredibly popular.
What does it look like?
It is colorful. It's witty. There's often hand-driven fonts on the cards, and it has its own very distinctive brand. There are colors that are regularly used, like pink and yellow and orange, and you know that it's Mr. Boddington when you see it. It's a really great sort of auger for the future of these design partnerships that we have, because we're actually being able to share a lot of revenue with these really talented designers and offer them a platform to get exposure to lots of visitors.
What was the last invitation you sent?
The last invitation I sent was a Chinese New Year invitation. It was for a dinner party that I'm having tonight. And it was on a card that looks like a gold coin, and it flips, and then there was sort of a witty joke, and then an invitation to dinner at 9.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.